It's like a warm blanket.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
We're going to miss our theme song. Oh, there it is. It's like Mystery Science Theater 3000. Okay, now we can start the show. All hands on deck.
Rev the engine.
All hands on deck. Such panic throughout the studio because our song didn't play.
I was like, Eddie, don't hit the ejector seat.
Get up. It's all going down. No one's going to listen now. They're going to think it's the old show.
How was your week, man?
It's good. I didn't, yeah, it was.
Did you do anything? Did you perform or anything?
No.
No, you're like.
I haven't been on stage in like 2 weeks. It's killing
what?
Me.
What? Why?
I just haven't gotten up.
Well, get it up.
I know.
Move.
I know.
Get it going.
I know.
Rev the engine. Well, what are you doing tonight after the show?
I'm going home.
You should go to the comic club.
No, because I'll just go there and stand and watch people, and I don't feel like.
Is that how it is? Like I mean, you know what? You have to bring me along one time. I want to just be your mute shadow.
Okay.
You'd be like, I'm
wow,
serious.
This is terrible.
No, because I don't know what it's like. Honestly, it's like I hear horror stories from you and other comics, but I want to just see it.
Like, not horror stories. It's just kind
no,
of,
but like bullshit politics.
If you don't go up, it's kind of boring. And I mean, you see some people you like, some of your friends or whatever. You hang out for a little bit. But.
Well, so they just make you wait hours until you go?
No, you don't have to wait. I mean, you're not going up. And if you're not on the show, the chances are you're not going up. I mean,
but
you might get lucky and someone drops out. And you're like, hey, could I get up? And maybe. But that's like, you know, 10% chance. 2%
so,
chance.
Okay, let's say I'm a new comic, all right?
Yeah.
I go to the – let's say I want to go big. I'm going to go to the Laugh Factory tonight. And I want to try and do a little 3-minute set. Is that possible?
No. Absolutely impossible.
So, okay, let's say can I just go up and say, hey, can you put me on at the end of the show?
You could. They're going to say no.
So then what do you do? You just do an open mic?
Yeah, if you're a new comic, yeah, you're just doing open mics.
That's rough. That's rough.
You're doing open mics, then you're trying to get good enough where you can get on some booked shows.
Well, how awesome was Brian last week? That was
Brian's
I played
amazing.
It for my family. Squalor's
amazing.
He had us rolling again. He had me rolling again.
He's one of the funniest comics I've ever met.
And you know what? You and he have to do a show together.
Yeah, maybe
we'll make it happen.
He's funny as shit. He's hilarious.
That's crazy. Yeah. That's crazy. That's
crazy nuts. What'd you do?
I actually did a gig on Saturday, but I was trying to post it on Facebook and. It was like a mystery post. It just never posted. So I actually played a gig.
Facebook's slimy.
Yeah,
they take your posts and they hide them.
I think sometimes they do.
Until you pay to promote them.
Yeah, I think sometimes
they do.
No, I'm serious.
They're dicks.
It wasn't a big deal. It was just like, you know, I do this these fashion mall gigs. And I love to do them because it gets me playing. You know, it's kind of like what you say about getting up.
Yeah.
Like you need to get up just to exercise the craft that you're at, you know, that you're doing. But yeah. It just felt good to play, but the last couple weeks that I've been doing it, it's been rainy, you know, so it was nice to have a beautiful day. Real quick, how crazy is it that it's now officially spring?
I know.
Winter daylight
saving
passed by like crazy. I'm sure.
Colin
has to be up like earlier now, right?
Yeah, you lose an hour. I don't know why we still have it. It's pointless. Daylight saving is pointless.
Yeah, it kind of is. I agree with you. Did you hear the latest verdict on the Pharrell Williams Blurred Lines versus Marvin Gaye suit?
No.
Do you know the Blurred Lines?
I don't even know what's going on.
Okay, so Blurred Lines, you know, it's a big song by Thick.
Yeah, I know that.
Okay, so you know that song.
I know the song.
So the Marvin Gaye estate sued Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke.
Why?
For plagiarism, basically. You know, like for stealing the sound that one of Marvin Gaye's songs.
So it's like a Ghostbusters and Huey Lewis type of thing?
Pretty much. It's kind of like Vanilla Ice stealing Queen's Under Pressure. Very similar kind of case.
But that was almost like, isn't that what they call sampling or something like that?
See, but Vanilla Ice didn't sample. He says he didn't sample it. He says his is different. So that's kind of what Pharrell and Thicke were saying. It wasn't exactly the same, but it was so derivative of it that it's been causing actually a lot of debates amongst musicians and other people. But
that song's like, what, 4 years old now? 3 years old?
Well, the Blurred Lines is about like 2 years old. And Marvin Gaye's song is like 30 years old. And the Marvin Gaye estate won $7.3 million for the, you know, Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams at the pay. But you know what? I think it's a good thing. You know, like musicians. I mean, I know you agree with me on this too. It's like, I think when you create anything as a creator, you want to feel like you're protected. You want to feel like if anybody was to take a good idea that you had or a good, you know, creative you know, expression that you used, that you deserve to be protected by the copyright. You know what I mean? It's like, whenever
is it that bad of a ripoff? Like, I don't know the
stomach. Well, here's the debate.
It can't just be like again, parallel thought. Like,
well, see, it's different words and it's different chord changes even, but it's the sound that's underneath all that is almost identically the same. So that's
well. What's the sound? What makes
it's
sound?
Like a funk? It's like a it's do you know this Marvin Gaye song? Gotta Give It Up.
Maybe if I heard it.
If you heard it, you've probably heard it at shopping malls or whatever. Anyways, it's almost – and when they went into the studio, Robin Thicke said to Pharrell, I want to make a song that sounds like this. And so they basically copied it and then made Blurred Lines. So, you know, a lot of artists do that when they create songs. But I think if you don't disguise it well enough, then, you know, it's kind of your fault, you know. So to me, I'm actually really happy about it because the same thing happened with Sam Smith and Tom Petty. Like he – blatant, like as soon as his song, what's the song that, you know, Stay With Me came out, I was like, this is a blatant ripoff of Tom Petty's verse for I Won't Back Down. And nobody was listening. And then all of a sudden, Tom Petty slammed him with a lawsuit and they settled because it is a basic ripoff of it. So what I like is that really, you know, solid artists are getting paid their due, you know what I mean? It's like they made this before any of these new artists came up with this stuff, and the whole point is to come up with something new.
But like, if you look at it as say like with a Thicke and then the Marvin Gaye thing, like his Blurred Lines song, I'm not defending.
I'm just saying,
does it did it really cost Marvin Gaye's estate money? Like, did it cost him sales of song? I mean, well, it sounds similar. I mean, it's not going to hurt the marketplace for either song.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you know about Robin Thicke before the song?
No, I barely know about him after the song.
Exactly. So the argument is no one knew him before the song. He stole this sound that is a blatant ripoff of a Marvin Gaye song, and now everybody knows him. And he made $15 million off the song. Plus, you know, there's more in advertisement revenue and stuff. This is just from sales. So he made millions off of the song. And he basically made millions off of a song that he didn't even give credit or say, you know, this was influenced by, you know, the Marvin Gaye family. And if he sampled Marvin Gaye's song, okay, you would have to pay the Marvin Gaye family 9 cents a copy. So, as you know, really, they probably would have only had to pay $90,000 or maybe, you know, a little bit more than that if they did it the right way. But they didn't. And because they didn't, the family is suing for damages. And I agree with it. It's like, you know what? You didn't do this the right way. Your label should have advised you. Yeah. The label got away scot-free. But the crazy thing is, you know, the artist came out on top. And, you know, I love both songs. That's the shame. You know, like,
but just I don't see it. Like, if a comic rips off another comic, then it's kind of like that comic's called a hack, and then like they're kind of like it kind of ruins them a little bit.
Right.
But with music, it just seems like it doesn't. Like, I don't see how it hurts either artist.
Well, it's kind of like
financially anyway. Like, I don't really, like, it's not. Well, it's not really hurting.
I don't think it hurt the estate, the Marvin Gaye estate.
They're not losing money or sales from their song.
It's more like, if you use a sample of a Marvin Gaye song, you know, and you make millions of dollars.
I understand, you should pay for the. If you're deliberately lifting a property,
then you should pay for it. And that's the argument. You know, they basically lifted a sound from a Marvin Gaye sound.
But with that's what gets me with music. Is like music is so, like, there's only so many arrangements.
Yeah. And you know, the
at
funny
some
thing
point,
is,
something's going to overlap.
Most people think when it says words of music by an artist, it's the chords and all. You can't copyright the chords, otherwise nobody would be able to use a G chord.
Yeah.
You know? But you know, it's the idea that you have to create something with the same amount of notes. Now, there's going to be a lot of melodies that are derived from, you know, 16th century music, 18th century music, whatever it is, because everybody's basically used the same notes.
Yeah.
But when a song is so blatantly obvious that it's stealing and not paying tribute in some sort of respect. I mean, Madonna and Lady Gaga had the same thing with Born This Way and Express Yourself. And Lady Gaga actually asked Madonna, I made a song that's very much like Express Yourself. You know, what kind of financial situation? And she said, no, you have my blessing. So they didn't do that. They were basically playing it off like, no, we created this. We're original. And in that sense, it's like, no, you're not. You actually just basically ripped off one of the best soul acts of our time. So it's a, you know, it's a big heated debate. And I'm glad to see things like that in the forefront of the news.
Interesting.
You know, just new things. Anyways, I believe our special guest has arrived. Mr. Rakesh Kumar. Filmmaker extraordinaire.
Extraordinaire. He's
got his first full-length feature film. And please tell us about your story. You have a tremendous story. Tell us where you're from. Tell us what, you know, made you want to make this movie.
Yeah, thank you, Nikhil. Thank you, Eddie.
No.
And it's a pleasure being here. And you guys are doing a tremendous job. Woo-hoo! Independent filmmakers like us on air, who have got absolutely zero chance being in front of any major studio right now.
Well, you know what? That's why we do this show. Yeah. We put a spotlight on voices that need to be heard, filmmakers, comedians, musicians. That's why we love doing it.
Plus, we're not in front of major studios either, so we have a lot of free time.
Speak for yourself, but no, I'm just kidding. I'm not in front of a major studio. Anyway, so talk to us about yourself, your story, what got you into filmmaking, what got you into wanting to make this movie.
Got it, sure. So, you know, a little bit about my background, that will make our listeners more understandable of where I'm coming from. So I was born in Bihar, that's in North India.
Right.
And, you know, if you ask any Indian what their opinion of Bihar is, they're going to tell you that it's a very poor place, and it had got its, like, caste problems and, you know, a whole lot of problems.
Now, Eddie, are you aware of the caste system in India?
No.
You're all like, right. Am I caste? Why don't you explain the caste system to Eddie?
Just like a basic caste system? Like you're born into a certain...
You're born, like a family is basically born into either the elite...
You can't really move up or down. You're kind of where you are.
Kind of, yes.
Yes. Okay.
You're not only... You're born with a particular caste, but also, you know, in the state of Bihar, there are caste wars. Extremely violent caste wars, like, you know, one caste attacking the village of another caste and pretty much decimating everyone. And there is no economy. Basically, you know, there is no Facebook, though, no Microsoft in that neighborhood.
Is it like a poorer caste attacks a more affluent caste? Or is it the other way around? Like, how is that?
It's free-for-all situation.
It kind of varies.
Yeah, it kind of varies.
It's actually like it's... Isn't the caste system, I mean, there's like a remnant of the caste system in place, but the caste system was supposed to be abolished, right?
Well, you know, racism is abolished in America.
Right, yes, very good parallel. So, like, racism was abolished here, but there's still traces.
Right, no. Yeah. There's more than traces. Was that established, like, from English rule, or, like,
That was, you know, in ancient India, 2,000 years back, you know, it was based on the profession you have. So there were four major castes, and, you know, the warrior caste, and the priests, and, you know, the agriculture caste, and, you know, the caste of, like, you know, shepherd, etc.
I was trying to think of what caste you'd be in. You'd be in agriculture. Just kidding.
But it was not tied to your birth. You know, you could be born in any profession, and depending on what profession you choose, you know, that becomes your sort of, like, you know, caste. And gradually, over a period of time, it was solidified, and, you know, it became on the basis of who your father is, where you're born. And typically, if you're born in a priest family, you're going to be a priest. If you're born in a warrior family, you're going to be a warrior. And then from these four major castes, hundreds and thousands of subcastes they came about, and you know, over a period of time, it became pretty watertight system. Like in a lot of conservative castes, you can be get killed if you marry outside your caste, and especially
you can't marry outside your caste.
Sounds like a lot of bullshit.
It is a lot of bullshit. It is. A lot of tradition and just
tradition sucks.
Yeah, I agree.
First and foremost,
in some ways, yes.
I hate tradition. In most cases.
No, I know what you mean. So, go on.
Yeah, so in that neighborhood, you know, working in film or working in basically any kind of art, that's sort of unheard of. Like, you know, you go to educate, you get yourself education, you find yourself a job. And if you find yourself a job, you are a pretty lucky dude.
Right.
And there onwards, you know, you just get married, you know, have kids, you know, raise kids, you know.
And people go to, like, medical school at 16. Yeah. It's not like it is here. It's totally different. Mm. You know, you pretty much know your career by your teenage years.
Ugh.
Would you agree? That's kind of how it is, right?
Absolutely. It's gross.
It's just crazy.
It's terrible.
Right?
So growing up, like, you know, you got like a couple of options. You can go to a medical school. You can go to an engineering school. That's your top two choices.
Those are the only two choices. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
Those are the money jobs.
Those are the money jobs. So, you know, if you don't get into any of these two, then you can find a government job. Then, you know, you can try to become a lawyer and eventually go to the business school, et cetera, et cetera.
And cool. Anything below that is basically that.
Picks up the garbage and cooks food and, like, works retail, like...
Well, those are all jobs. They're just not – they don't have this – they don't hold the respect. And a lot of it – the real hard thing with Indian culture that I know is it's also the families hold this reputation, right?
Yeah.
It's like mm-hmm. it's – you know, you're – I would say your elders are basically represented by their careers and also what their kids do. Would
absolutely,
you say that's –
absolutely, yeah.
That's the same?
Seems like some really poorly misplaced values.
Well, it's I don't know how it even came about, but it just –
the thing
the way
is, you know, unlike, you know, many other cultures, it's Indian parents, they spend pretty much their entire focus on their kids. So it's not like, you know, you can't go on until one fine morning you wake up and you tell your family, hey, guys, you know, I got this. You know, I figured it out here onwards. You know,
yeah.
Go do your own thing. No, because they have, like, you know, made a lot of sacrifices for you. So when it time comes, when, you know, you can, in a way, you know, you can never really pay back your parents.
Right. No, you can't.
In a way, you can do something that makes you feel happier. You do that. Like, you know, if I was, I would come to that point a little bit later. But growing up, for example, if I decided to become like a filmmaker, and, you know, I was not successful. If I was successful, great. But if I was not successful, and I ended up, you know, basically, you know, being working on a retail joint. By the way, you know, working in retail
right.
joint in India, it's not like, you know, working for minimum wages. You're looking at pretty grim situation there. You're looking at, you know, something like, you know, 50 cents an hour, you know, that kind of wages.
Wow.
So it's pretty brutal. You know, you don't have, like, you know, health insurance, like, you know, any such thing. And basically, you know, if you don't succeed in movie industry, you're done. Like, you know, you really die of hunger in a way. So, you know, I could have decided to go that route and decided to, like, make myself a filmmaker at the age of 21. But you don't do that because in the back of your mind, you kind of think of your parents and you think of all the sacrifices, you know, that
right.
they make for you. And then you
decide, base your decision.
You
on
base
that.
Your decision. So even if, like, you're no matter
how, just kidding.
Yeah, how strongly you feel about a particular thing,
right?
You have to think about the ones you love and the, you know, ones who love you. That, like, you know, how it's gonna, like, you know, reflect on them. Like, for example, if I want to go to space and spend there, like, you know, 15 years, you know, lot of our listeners, maybe they have the idea they can take a one way ticket to Mars. The thing is, like, you know, how does
maybe,
it...
Maybe, yeah, if you're out there.
Yeah. How would your loved ones really, are they going to take it? So you need to think about them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, like, you know, one of the very central part of, like, the way I think and the way, you know, this movie is that your life is about you, but it also about the people that you love and the people who love you.
Well, because you represent them, like, in name and who you are. It's like, you know, I think there's a lot of status on success.
Mm-hmm.
And... unfortunately, you know, because India is so, I think Indians in general are so based, they focus on the finances. You could be miserable but be a millionaire and you're a success to, you know, a family. Whereas to me, I'm like, not if you don't love what you do, if you're not doing things for the right reasons, if you're not living from the heart, you know. But that's just the way it's tradition. It's just the way things are.
Why is it like that there? Why is it so...
You know, that millionaire thing is just pretty much applicable anywhere in the world.
That's true. So, I agree.
Yeah. In the corporate cultures, I've seen people who are pretty much, like, pretty fucked up, like, you know, miserable in their
yeah.
lives.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are, like, you know, senior directors, VPs, you know, et cetera, et cetera, like Tesla, you know, big houses, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, they're happy. Thing is, you know, very few of them would actually take this opportunity and grab this opportunity and, you know, risk everything for something that they love doing. Like, you guys were talking about music, you're a comic, he's a musician.
Yeah.
You know, if, for example, all of a sudden, imagine yourself 15 years down the line and both of you are, like, you know, VPs of a, you know, very big company or something, then at that point, you know, you have got lot to lose if you just, like, you know, take that chance. And if you take that chance, then truly you're following your passion. In fact, while walking in here, I saw a very famous quote from Steve Jobs there, right outside
your door. Yeah, right outside the window, yeah.
Yeah, stay hungry, stay foolish. It's very important to do that, but also it's incredibly hard to stay hungry or stay foolish. Like, you know, right now, man, like, you know, I made my first film.
Right.
You know, my entire savings is in there. And I sort of, like, you know, get sleepless night.
Oh, of course. You know, especially that it's your first step, though. Yes, you know what I mean? It's like, I remember I did that with my first full-length record, and I had the same feeling.
You financed,
like,
your first full-length record?
Oh, yeah. Man, it was not – and I went to big studios and had big musicians playing on it, the biggest musicians that I could find or friends with or whatever playing on the record just to bring something to the table. And, you know, I had – Michael Jackson's engineer running it, who I still work with, you know.
Yeah.
But all these contacts were made with that first big push, and it was humbling because you're putting not only your blood, sweat, and tears, but also everything that you know. You're clearing your savings to throw it in.
I mean, that's the one. Like, that's like a lot of people, tell you that in the film. It's like always OPM, you know, like other people's money. Like, don't use your own money to do.
But you know what? At the same thing. Like, I know people that did it the other way, that used other people's money, and I'm a lot farther along.
Well, you have more freedom when it's your own money.
Yeah, because you can do what you want. You can direct where the course goes. You learn a lot more when you do it that way. So the sleepless nights, you know, I'm going to tell you something that you may not believe, but 10 years from now, you're going to look at those sleepless nights that you're having, you know, as your film is making the journey into people's, you know, psyche or in their homes or whatever. And, you know, it's a very alive place that you're at. And it's actually where a lot of art comes from. So use it to your advantage. And I know that you are. I know you told us you're already writing your next film. But let's talk about this first movie first. So you have a pretty unique story. Yeah. You went to law school, correct?
That's right, yeah.
And you actually graduated from law school. You were a lawyer for how many years?
I was a lawyer for around 2.5 years.
Okay, and you did contractual law?
Contract and constitutional. So,
you went to law school longer than you were a lawyer.
That's right.
Is that what you're saying?
That's true.
Studying to be a lawyer longer than you actually were a lawyer.
I know a lot of you. That's one profession I actually know. I have a couple friends that did the same thing. They were like, okay, I'm going to do law. Yeah. And they're in the process of, yep, I'm going to be a lawyer. Yep, that's it. Then they become a lawyer and they're like, this is not what I want to do. I don't want to do anything even close to this. I'm done with this.
It's just crazy because it's got to be so hard to get through law school, I would imagine.
Well, you just
it seems like one of the harder degrees to get, a law degree.
Well, so I guess it's one of those things where you feel...
And then you get done with it, you're like,
I don't want to do it anymore. Well, you feel like, oh, once I finish this, then I'll be happy. Exactly. Then I'll, you know, reach that success level.
I would have figured that out the first semester.
You know?
Like, yeah, this
but
is not,
you don't,
not
though. It's
this.
Like it's like going through film school. You're like, okay, once I finish this, then I'll start.
I knew halfway through film school, I'm like, this is not what I want.
In fact, you bring out a very interesting point that, you know, once you do this, you know, then onwards, like, you know, you'd be happy. That's what my film is called, After Ever After. And we are constantly pursuing this thing. Once I finish the law school, it will be Happily Ever After. And once I make my first film, it will be Happily Ever After.
So I actually loved the title. When I saw the title, I was like, this is such a cool title. Go on, what were you saying?
So After Ever After, that examines what really happens in that Happily Ever After for regular Jews like us. You know, does it mean, like, you know, we are going to be partying for the rest of our life?
Right.
You know, we will become all of a sudden a jet setter and we'll become billionaires and everything. Like, you know, I don't know. Everybody has got their own, they have their own notion of, like, you know, what Happily Ever After should be. This film examines what Happily Ever After means through an eye of an alcoholic father trying to explain the meaning of Happily Ever After to his 9-year-old terminally sick daughter. So this guy has really nothing to look forward to. There is no Happily Ever After to his story.
Right.
Then he's a doctor, he's a physician. and he has a chance encounter with an Alzheimer's patient. This Alzheimer's patient was a jazz musician, jazz legend of his times, you know, like Marvin Gaye. Like,
yeah,
he was.
Yeah,
in that
stage. I'm a big jazz advocate. Yeah. Jazz is okay in my book.
So he was a superstar of his times, and you know he had everything that like ordinary like Jews like us we imagine. You know, fame, money, you know, success, doing things that you want to do. You know, everything by the book, everything like you're blessed. But now he has Alzheimer's. Something is troubling him, and he has just got one memory left, and he is freaking out every now and then. So this doctor is sent in to examine what's really wrong with him. And through his interaction, he figures out what his last memory actually is. And
the jazz musicians.
Jazz musicians. And when interesting. It's not his fame or money. Basically, it's nothing to do with like you know, what we would ordinarily think of. But when he figures out what that last memory is...
It's like Rosebud.
Yeah, something like Rosebud, exactly. Yeah, so then he figures out what happily ever after really means. And, you know, it's not like you don't really think that I'm going to do this particular thing, you know. Our radio show, you know, will become a national phenomenon, then we'll be happily ever after. No, it's a right. journey. You have to be happy, enjoy every moment that yep. comes along with it.
I tell Eddie that every show.
And I start yawning like I'm doing right. Yeah. Yeah.
Easy there. Don't be so dramatic.
No, but that's really, you know what's cool about your perspective on this film? It's like you actually, you teach the viewer, because the viewer's going through it with the father, correct?
Yes.
He's like watching this father go through, you know, there's nothing worse than seeing a child of yours going through a life-threatening illness.
Yeah.
And then... he interacts with a stranger. I guess he's a stranger, essentially, right?
Yeah.
And this stranger, not even being able to recapture his own life,
yeah.
teaches him how to live his own life.
Yes.
You know, that's what's kind of... When I was reading the backstory mm-hmm. of the movie, I was like, this is touching on so many issues that I love. You know, it's like, it's just a very... I think it's poignant. And, we don't get enough of those kind of movies and stories. Especially in Hollywood, you know, it's like.
And this was the first thing you ever directed. This was it, right?
Yeah, Eddie. Basically, you know, I went to a movie set when I had to shoot my first scene. Before that, I had never seen a movie set.
That's crazy.
That's incredible.
Did you surround yourself with like experienced crew that could help you like walk you through it? How did you assemble the crew that you put together? So, I mean, because like, I could imagine, I mean, going to a movie set now, and I've been on several, it's still an intimidating thing. Mm-hmm. But to actually be on your first movie set and it's your feature.
So I was the writer, so I sort of like knew what I need. And there's one thing I would credit to, I worked for Apple for 7 years. And that part I will credit to Apple that, they have, when you're working for Apple, you really don't know what you would be doing, what the next big project is. You know, a lot of times you are literally thrown into, the middle of the thing, and you need to figure out, ask right question, team up with right people, and, you figure out by that 80-20 rule, start doing the right things. So I did
my... The clock is ticking. Just kidding, Apple.
So long. Stop it. How does it... When is it in? Okay.
So, sort of gave me a little bit of how it would be at the Oscars, but regardless.
Well, did it also teach you, with Apple, a lot of the creative programs mm-hmm. are Apple-based. Mm-hmm. So did you actually learn editing and all of that stuff while you were working with Apple?
And no, I did not. So at that point, by the 80-20 rule, one thing, I knew that the story needs to be right.
Right.
You need to have a good story, a good script, something that people can relate to. Second, the acting needs to be good.
Yeah.
And third thing, you need to capture, that acting into camera correctly. And everybody else in the team, they should not just mess up. That's their job. The continuity guy should not mess up. Nobody should basically mess up. But if the acting is strong, the story is strong, acting is strong, and it is captured in a reasonable manner on a camera, people will enjoy it. They would let you off if your watch is on the left hand in one scene, and in the same scene 15 seconds later there is no watch, people may be forgive you for that.
But they probably won't notice it, to be honest.
Yeah.
Eddie would.
Yeah, the film critics
would. Well, people are trained to watch,
Yeah. But in general, if the story is strong, if you draw the audience into the story, then that's where, you know, that's where by 80-20 rule, you're 80% dead.
You just gave me chills because I think every great piece of art is a story.
Yeah.
So we're all storytellers. That's like, you know, when I was teaching, that's what I would call my students. Mm-hmm. I'd call them storytellers because that's what it is. Mm-hmm. And I love that you're coming in here and you're talking about making this movie. It's your first movie, and you're so story-based. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with this story?
This story is based mostly on my personal experience. And I lost a loved one to cancer. And, you know, I've seen Alzheimer's, you know, very, very closely. So it was a lot of basically anything, you know, when you see the movie, and most of the dialogues in the movie, most of the situations in the movie, that they have happened in my real life. Obviously, you know, I've modified them to make it a coherent story, you know, storyline. But most of the things that are being said there, you know, they are personal experience. So they are straight from heart. So I never had a doubt about the story because, you know, I was somehow, like, you know, if you give a story through right from your heart, people know whether it's a song, whether it's a piece of art, you know, movie. If you put your heart into it, people know. And if you don't put your heart into it, then no matter how brilliant the cinematography is,
you get Transformers 4.
That's what happens. Very true. Well, let's play a little scene. We got a little blurb for our listeners. Check this out. This is a scene from
After Ever After.
Any luck?
Nope. Showed him everything. Whole kit and caboodle.
There has to be something. What is this?
His statement after he was diagnosed. Showed that too.
Read it to him.
Slowly, one sentence at a time. When my doctor told me that I got Alzheimer's, I found it hard to believe that the ocean of thoughts, melodies, songs that my mind holds will be gone one day. But I've accepted the reality, and today I want to share with you something about that ocean. However vast it might be, our share of it is only those few drops that we can hold in our palm. Those few drops that actually touch us. All of you have touched my life, and you will be there long after the ocean fades. Music will remain long after the show is over, and the guy from Fresno will always love that music. He'll always love you.
Read that again.
It's awesome. That was cool. So tell me the scene, like you were talking. Tell us, kind of play us, run us through that scene. Studio audience, loves it. So run that scene, like just give us like the backstory with that scene.
Sure. So... As we just talked, that this man is trying to figure out what this memory is in his mind. So they decide to show him all the important people, places, and events of his life. That hopefully, you know, something will strike a chord with him. So they get his life together in an album, and basically, you know, everything that they could think of that's important. So that had his, like, him being, winning the Grammys, you know, him being with Elvis, him being at the White House dinner, him being in a major concert, his first concert, all those, like, you know, big events in his life. He doesn't remember anything at all. Zero. Nothing really, like, you know, strikes a chord with him. So that's when this scene happens. So his doctor goes out and, you know, his caregiver basically, you know, flips through the entire file. He doesn't remember anything. Then this doctor noticed this piece of paper. So he asks, what is it? So it's the statement after he was, his statement after he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So basically he told all his fans that someday, you know, I'm going to forget everything, all my melodies, you know, songs, etc., etc. But, you know, love will always be there.
Huh. It's a good message.
Your love will always be there. And, you know, I'll always love the people who loved me. You know, even if I don't recall you, you know, don't remember you, you know.
There's love there.
Love is there. Somehow it will always be there. That one cell of my brain can never be destroyed. That's called love. You know, Alzheimer's can take away everything, but you know, that one cell, you know, cannot be destroyed. And So that is when, you know, it sets out his journey. So when he was reading in the scene, when he was, you know, this statement was being read to this old man, his eyes flicker at a particular point.
Right.
So that's the first clue for this doctor.
A spark, right?
Yeah, that's a spark. That's the first clue for the doctor that, okay, you know, he recalls something. And you know, this scene, again, is inspired, you know, by my own life.
Right. So there's parallels.
There are parallels. There are parallels in there. And, you know, I was born in a pretty not so well, economically well-off family. And I was homeschooled by my grandfather.
Wow.
And, you know, he always wanted me to go to this big, you know, big school, which was, you know, get myself like a scholarship and go to this big school. And, you know, he really prepared me pretty hard for that one. And eventually I go to that school. So later on in his life, he pretty much like, you know, forgot everything. But he remembered one thing. That he always asked that, like, you know, where I was, did I go to that school?
Wow, really?
Yeah.
That's a pretty impressive.
Yeah.
It's weird what the mind holds on to, right?
Yeah.
When
yeah.
things,
yeah.
like, start getting lost, you know, yeah. the shuffle.
Yeah.
You told me, you know, before when I was asking you about this movie, when we weren't on the air, you said this movie, in essence, took you 12 years to live
mm-hmm.
and took you 2 years to write.
Yep.
What was that process like putting the story on paper? Like reflecting on your own life and putting it on paper. Like you obviously are making yourself vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
You're making your experiences, you know, known.
Yeah.
What was that experience and that process like for you? Because this was a new, this is kind of a new shift mm-hmm. in your paradigm, you know?
Yeah. Lot of times, you know, writing in a lot of scenes while thinking about them, I prefer to be alone because I knew that, you know, I'll cry. So, yeah. So, you know, you should be prepared to do that. And, you know, as I said, it needs to come from your heart.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, ripping your heart, like, you know, open, you know,
yeah.
revisiting your old wounds, it's not really easy.
I think, you know, just reading the little blurb on the movie that I did, it kind of just puts like what you personally have, you whatever, you know, aims or goals you have in life, it just puts things in check.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just reading about, okay, this you know, father is dealing with a sick child and then, you know, comes in contact with somebody with Alzheimer's. There's two different illnesses,
mm-hmm.
completely contrasting, mm-hmm. completely kind of life-threatening on both, you know, sides mm-hmm. of the scale. And it just puts whatever you're going into, you know, going through emotionally or physically or, you know, business-wise or financially, it just puts all those things in check. That's what I liked about how you present your story. It's very poignant. It's like so many people just focus on, oh, this is what I want to do. This is my goal in life, and that's it. And you don't think about health. Health is like, I would say, one of the number one things we take.
You don't think about it until you lose it.
You don't think about it,
right? Until you lose it.
Not until you lose it. So it's like when you have a story.
It's like your car. You don't think about your car until it breaks down.
Yes.
It's the same. It's like, you know.
It's the worst when it does. It's a very great analogy.
Yeah.
So what I like about it is it touches on things that we all take for granted. Things that, you know, we may not all be dealing with. But I think just with the story alone, with that, I think it's a great message, you know.
There's this great, you know, we can all find it on YouTube, you know, the last lecture by Randy Pausch. And one of the very important things that he said, that we all live as if we have got finite money. We are very careful with our money. But we live as if we have got infinite time.
Right.
That's not is the reality. If there's one thing that's finite, for sure, that's time.
So true.
Yeah. And in this film, I chose these two illnesses because, you know, obviously it was both of them were linked with my personal journey, but also both of them, you know, in a way are extremely hard to cure. Alzheimer's is like not curable, so
yeah.
You can only provide care. And in cancer, you can only cure it to a certain extent. But regardless, no matter how bad that illness is, that cannot defeat any illness, anything cannot really defeat the human spirit, the spirit of an artist.
Yes.
You know? And that is what this film is.
And love, about. Honestly. It's like, that's what it's about. It's like how you impact people.
I noticed watching the clip, I you're the lead, right?
Yeah.
And you can you. I mean, that's a huge. That's a ballsy thing to do. Like your first feature, and you're going to direct it, and you're going to write it, and you're going to act in it as the lead. That's crazy. That's hard to do. That's difficult to do.
Thank you, Eddie. And since it's an independent film and, you know, very limited funding, you're not only the writer, director, but you're also the janitor, driver.
Itself. Yeah, you're everything. You're like, I got to get these people food. I mean,
That's so true. Yeah. I've been there.
I mean, I've shot stuff. I've gone to film school. I've created things. I've had things shot, and I've directed and acted, and it's very difficult to split your brain.
Well, it's hard to do one of those things.
It's hard to do one of those things.
And when you do 30 of them,
but,
that's a whole
I mean, it's different. Hard to do your own independent projection, but just to be an actor and try to focus on what you're trying to deliver as an actor, while at the same time having the director's mind of, like, do I have the coverage I need? Are these other performances up to par? Like, all this other stuff that's going on. But I mean, it's very difficult to do. And, I mean, I just from the clip that I saw, you did it very well, you know? Yeah.
Thank you. So. We did our homework pretty well. We rehearsed. Yeah. And, you know, I had very detailed discussions with the DP, and DP was phenomenal.
Who was the DP?
Paul Nordine.
Okay.
Of EMBS Studio. Paul Nordine, he did a great job. And basically, I was, in a way, I was very lucky to have, such an amazing cast and crew for my first one.
That's what I was asking, because filmmaking is such a collaborative effort. Yeah. Like, that's what I was wondering. Like, your first time directing, never been on a film set before, did you surround yourself with, like, the best people you could get to help this whole thing run smoother.
The best people I can get, that's for sure. They did an awesome job. So,
It looks beautiful. It was shot beautifully.
That's the one thing I noticed, is it was shot beautifully. I was like, wow, this is such a colorful production, and it's story-based. I'm like, I'm going to instantly love this.
What's your filmmaking influences? I mean, do you have...
Good question, Eddie.
Well, I'm just like, because like, I know Indian filmmakers are very colorful. There's a lot of colors and vibrant colors in Indian films. I mean, from what I've studied film before, and I went to film school with someone who was from India, and his films were always very vibrant color wise. And I was just wanting to see if that's just part of I just want to know if that's part of your influence. Were you influenced by Indian filmmakers? Are you more American filmmakers?
The storytelling was definitely influenced more by the American filmmakers. There are some very commendable names in Indian filmmaking, Mahesh Bhatt, his first film Sharan, so that's like a big influence on me. Then Forrest Gump is a very big influence on me.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
It's a great movie. It's entertaining. It's art. It has got everything. A lot of times, like in the name of art, we make such slow movies that only very niche audience is going to watch it. But something which is very good, very artistry, and also can be watched by a very large group of audience, can reach out, connect to like a large group of people. That's really great. And obviously Spielberg, nobody beats him. And then.
Not as of late, but yes, you're right.
And, there's one person whose influence is not there in this particular movie, but I'm a great admirer of his. That's the Tarantino.
Yeah.
And my second film, God of Foot Soldiers, that will have, I will study his style a little bit more for my second one. And I want my second one to be completely different than the one that you guys are going to see.
Are you going to be the lead in that one too?
I haven't decided about that. I'll play one part maybe, but not that big of a deal.
Did you have a lot of acting experience going in, or is this the first thing you ever acted in?
The first time I ever acted was the first scene of my own film.
What?
Wow. Yeah.
No rehearsal or anything?
No, rehearsal I had done, but in front of camera, never.
Wow.
So you should retire this Poppin' Cherry. I mean, the first time, everything is a first on this film. This is crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a huge, I'm just thinking, number. Like, everything you did is, like, such a huge, I mean, you put your own money into a feature that you wrote, that was your first thing you wrote, the first thing you directed, the first thing you acted. I mean, that's incredibly brave.
Yep.
That's incredibly brave.
Honestly.
Thank you. That's why, I request
our borderline crazy. Incredibly brave and crazy at the same time. It's insane. But that's commendable as hell.
So that's, www.aeathemovie.com. That's our website.
Aeathemovie.com.
I was just about to ask you, where can people find it? www.aeathemovie.com. T-H-E-M-O-V-I-E.
.com.
movie.com.
They got themovie.com, I think. Well, just I think they can figure that out.
You can find us there. And you can find us on Facebook, Facebook.com/AEA the movie. And, you know, our trailer, we have the short trailer out, and I would request our listeners to look at the trailer and leave a comment there, let us know.
And where are you trying to get it? I know you're probably trying to get distribution, all that stuff. What avenues are you looking? Are you looking into streaming, Netflix and Amazon, Hulu, that type of stuff, or where are you trying to go with it?
So the plan A. So the plan A is
Yeah, IMAX is plan A.
So let's...
Of course.
So the plan A is to go to Cannes Film Festival, win the Cannes Film Festival,
right.
Get a whole big theatrical release, etc., etc. And we are living in a world where we really don't need to get distribution. We can go ahead and self-distribute, tomorrow. It's just a question of how many people know about the...
Yeah, brand. Marketing
it. And...
Building the brand.
So... I'm trying in all possible avenues. So I've submitted to Cannes Film Festival. So not only in the main competition, but also in the Director's Fortnight, Critics' Choice, Essence Program, etc. And I will do some festival rounds. I'll try to show it to
Well, you want to get some of your money back, some.
Well,
so you can make the second movie.
Yeah, that's true. And
it's also the buzz. I mean, people, if the story's there and people gravitate towards the story. It'll get known. You know what I mean? It's all about getting eyeballs to see it, getting people to see
it. But I would promote a lot of it, your story behind the movie.
Yep.
Just like, this is my dream. I was a lawyer for 2 seconds. I worked for Apple.
For Apple? I mean,
I spent all my money. It's my first time I wrote, directed, and act. Like, that's the incredible story behind the actual story is as much a selling point of this movie as the movie itself.
Dude, Eddie, you're the shit.
I'm just saying,
where have you been?
I'm just saying, kidding. That's amazing. That's an amazing thing.
No, it is. It honestly,
that story itself. I mean, regardless,
it's commendable.
That you based the movie on real life occurrences, losing someone with leukemia and Alzheimer's. I mean, that stuff makes for the great story that you created. But the story that went into making the story is an amazing story.
Thank you, Eddie.
And you should tell that to help sell this.
Yeah,
film.
I agree. I think the story behind the story is a movie in and of itself.
You can
make your second movie on the story.
The making of this movie, I'm sure, is interesting as the movie itself.
Because
very few people in this business take the risks and chances
you took to
make this movie.
Yeah, you took big risks. You gave up a lot, and. You did it on your own dime, and not a lot of artists
That's commendable, and that should sell this movie as much as the movie itself.
I agree.
Thank you.
He's like, well, I need 500,000 of you guys.
I'm just saying, it's just crazy. It's amazing.
No, it's that's what it's about. That's why we do this, right? That's why we make art, is to get our voice heard, and you have a story to tell. And the amazing thing is the universe created your story, and you created a movie out of your story, and that is just... what it's all about. So, Rakesh, we wish you the best of luck. I can't wait to watch this movie. One more time, where can everybody find you?
www.aeathemovie.com. That's our website.
aeathemovie.com.
And where can we find you on Facebook?
facebook.com/aeathemovie. That's where you can find us. And if you go to our website, leave a comment for us. We'll be sure to get back to you.
Awesome. Rakesh, I can't wait till you come back and you have more movies to share with us.
Yeah, put me in a movie.
Thank you, Eddie.
Eddie's available.
I'm available.
Thank you, Eddie. Thank you, Nicholas. It was great being here.
It was our pleasure. And we look forward to hearing more from you. So thank you for your story, and thank you for making a movie that we can all enjoy.
Thank you.
We'll see you here next week, everybody.
Good night, Hollywood.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kawula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.